Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Frank Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and one of the hosts of the morning show.
We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about a fascinating story and fascinating book, a book called The Icon Hunter, A Refugee's Quest to Reclaim Her Nation's Stolen Heritage. The author, Tasula Hajitofi, is someone who grew up on the beautiful nation of an island of Cyprus. In 1974, she and her family were displaced by an invasion by the Turkish military. And it radically altered the trajectory of her life and also, at least indirectly, led to what became a mission of hers over the course of many, many years to seek to reclaim some of the priceless religious artifacts, icons, and paintings that had been stolen by the Turks during that invasion and occupation of Cyprus in 1974. And Tasula Hajitofi had to work through all kinds of different intermediaries in the often very shadowy and unpredictable world of the black market for stolen art. And she tells the story of this extraordinary odyssey in her new book called The Icon Hunter, A Refugee's Quest to Reclaim Her Nation's Stolen Heritage. The book is published by Pegasus Books. And Tasula Hajitofi, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you very much for having me on the show. Good morning, America.
Really good to be talking with you. I want to find out first from you about your memories of Cyprus before the Turkish invasion in 1974. Tell us where you and your family lived and what life was like for you.
I was born in Famagusta, which is a city on the coast, and before the war, we were about 65,000 citizens. I come from a middle-class family with four children. I was the second of two. And the life in Famagusta before the war was near the sea, going to the beach every day, going to school. But the weekends was for us church, because we are Christian Orthodox. And after the church, a life outdoor, you know, playing in the historical ruins of Salamis or going to the Kantara Castle or spending the weekends with my grandparents in the village. So that was life in Famagusta back then.
Tell us or describe what occurred in 1974.
Well, of course, I'm just like every other child. I had many, many dreams, and dreams to go abroad and study and do this and that. And I went to bed one night in 1974 in the summer as a free girl full of dreams and, you know, having my pets, and woke up in the morning with the bombing and the airplanes dropping napalm bombs in Cyprus. So that experience of war, seeing the devastation of war from a child's point of view, makes me actually understand so very well the refugees of today, the children from Syria, from Iraq, from everywhere else. Because when you experience war, your life just changes overnight, and each one of us has a different way of dealing with it. And for me, I chose to be a silent witness for many, 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 many years because I could not revisit that space until almost 42 years later when I came to write my book.
Hmm. Explain, although this isn't, of course, the main point of our conversation nor of your book, but briefly explain why this invasion occurred, the relationship between Cyprus and Turkey, and maybe more specifically, the sometimes tense relationship between the Turks who lived on Cyprus and others who were there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is a very big topic and a very political topic. So I think we have to start from the point of view that things we used to do in the past, we should not be allowed to do today. So, of course, during the colonial times, there were a lot of divide and rule by colonialism. And in the case of Cyprus in 1960, when the first Republic of Cyprus was formed, the British gave us a constitution which was based on discrimination, in the sense that the Greek and Turkish Cypriots living on the island, the Muslims and the Christians coexisting on the island, suddenly we were given a constitution which separated us, meaning that 30% of the public positions were given to the Muslim minority, which was 18. And, of course, that offended the Greek Cypriots. But the most important thing is, when you look for a solution in any conflict, if it is not based on human rights, which is one man, one vote, we are all equal, to build one country, you end up creating divisions in the society. And I think that the Cyprus issue, that is really where it began. It was that we were never given a republic day one where we were one voice, one loyalty, one identity. That constitution caused drift amongst the people of Cyprus. The majority of us lived happily together, but we had extremists that every now and then, you know, rocked the boat. So Turkey came to, first Greece came in 1974 to kill Makarios, who was the president at the time, and bring coup d'etat in Cyprus. And Turkey used that opportunity to invade Cyprus with the excuse to liberate their minority. And 42 years later, Turkey occupies 40% of the island.
One of the most painful aspects of that invasion, and of course this is what gets us to the heart of your book, is the fact that during that invasion, a number of different Greek Orthodox churches were ransacked, and out of many of those churches, various icons were stolen. I appreciate the fact that in your book you help us try to come to understand, I mean, those of us who might be, you know, Lutherans or Methodists or whatever, and yes. and not so deeply acquainted with your particular faith, you help us try to understand what these objects mean and what it means when they are torn away from you. Say a word about that, about the place of such artifacts in Greek Orthodox worship and the extent to which such priceless objects were stolen during this invasion.
Thank you for this. I think that in order to start, we have to understand the place of Cyprus in history. And Cyprus was one of the first Christian churches established by St. Barnabas. St. Paul and St. Barnabas came to Cyprus straight after Antiochia to preach Christianity. So there is a lot of history and Byzantine monuments and iconography in Cyprus which survived the iconoclasm. Also, Cyprus is very, very rich historically. So for us, our weekends was playing in historical ruins and going to the church to pray, and that is part of our rituals and DNA. Now, the icons or frescoes is when we color scenes of the Bible on the walls of the church, and each church is actually full of these paintings, full of these passages of the Bible from the floor to the ceiling, and we use this space to communicate with the divine via these paintings. So when we pray with the icons, we need those icons to communicate with Virgin Mary or St. Paul. So they're vital and artifacts in the sense of they're vital things to our religious expression. They are not commodities. So we carry icons in our purses. We carry crosses on our neck or icons. We have them next to our bed. This is our daily ritual. So when, for example, someone destroys a church or drills the wall to take the head of a saint, it is very, very devastating because it shows disrespect for my faith, total disrespect. So it shows a barbaric act. You know, just like we watch today the ISIS blowing up historical monuments or destroying churches, it's just the same thing. I don't accept your diversity. I don't respect your religious freedom, and I'm going to trade it for cash.
Right.
That is what it means. Now, when you come from conflict zones like I do, what do you have to hold on? For me, what I have to hold for is the memories of my home, the memories of my weekends to the chapels, the memories of my community, which was around these historical and religious monuments. So, of course, I want to protect them because those were my happy times before war changed me.
We're speaking with Tulusa Hajitofi and talking about her book, The Icon Hunter, A Refugee's Quest to Reclaim Her Nation's Stolen Heritage. You tell us that it was bad enough that so many of these works, I mean, really thousands of them, were stolen during this Turkish invasion in 1974. But that beyond it, unfortunately, the church in Cyprus, I believe I remember this correctly, kept rather vague or incomplete records. So in other words, the written legacy of inventory was not perfectly clear, and that would make the task of retrieving these stolen items all the more difficult.
Correct. But let me share with you the following. That the churches before the war, it was, and the houses, I mean, security in Cyprus was not an issue. We used to have them unlocked because we wouldn't dare go and steal an icon. It wouldn't cross our mind. And then we never ever thought of cataloging each church about its contents, because you just don't think that someone is going to want to trade them for cash. It doesn't enter your mind. Having said that, though, we have to appreciate that the law, if you look at the letter of the law, yes, you do have to have records and show that it originated from this place and that place and to have evidence in order to repatriate it. But the spirit of the law, when there is war and conflict and there is this systematic looting, we have to look at it that it is not dealt with in the national legislation and it is a private property issue dealt with national law. It should be criminal law, and we should look for the war tribunals in The Hague and all around the world to look for brave prosecutors to bring those to justice who systematically perform cultural cleansing in war zones. That is what we should be looking at, and not tell countries make records. Of course, it's good to do records, but what do we do for those who don't have complete records?
Right. We happen to be recording this interview on Holocaust Remembrance Day. And you take a little bit of time in your book to talk about what is sort of the parallel story of how the Nazis looted so many Jewish art collections. And you trace at least some of the extensive efforts to recover some of that stolen artwork and bring it back into proper hands. But there are certain things about this particular story that were different in terms of what was possible.
Well, the legislation for Nazi-looted art is different than for cultural heritage. I am not a lawyer, but I have worked with some of the best in the world, And also in Walk of Truth, an NGO that I founded to protect cultural heritage. We have a lot of volunteer lawyers and activists who help me. My understanding is when you try to repatriate Nazi-looted art, there is no statute of limitation or it is extended to 75 years plus. That means when you find an artifact within 100 years, you can still reclaim it if you have evidence. That is one, where for cultural heritage in many of the European countries, we have statutes of limitation after 20 years. And in criminal cases, if you can prove that you possess a looted art for 10 years and then you trade it, trading stolen looted art is not a criminal offense, for example, in Germany, but it is a civil case. Now, with Nazi looted art, by not having the statutes of limitation, of course you have more time to do so. The other difference is that there are restitution committees around the world where for Nazi looted art, the two inter-affected parties can agree to go to the restitution committee. And the restitution committee will evaluate the merits of the case and then give a binding advice as to who is the legal owner today of the Nazi looted art. In cultural heritage, you have to go to court, either national legislation applicable in the country where the artifact is found, maybe international laws are applicable, or collaboration between countries, MOU in the case of the USA, how it is exported, and all of that costs time, money, and when there is war and there is immense devastation of culture, you can't chase each repatriation and spend millions of dollars on each legal case. Where will Syria and Iraq find that money to do so? Or where would poor Cyprus do so?
The heart and soul of your book is about your tireless efforts to try and help recover at least some of this stolen artwork from your homeland. And what is so intriguing about this is that you are forced to descend into this murky, disconcerting world of the art black market. And you have to deal with people who have such shady pasts and are so untrustworthy, so unpredictable. And in order to broker certain alliances that will ultimately bring you to your final goal, you write at one point about feeling as if you were living in a perpetual game. Just talk about what it felt like to be engaged in alliances and negotiations with these kind of people who were so difficult to trust or predict.
Okay, thank you. Well, first of all, I think my drive comes from my inability to go back home. As I explained, in 1974, I became a refugee, and the town that I was born, Famagusta, Varosha, is a ghost city. So until today, I can look at that city, but nobody lives there. So the fact that I can stand and look at my city, and I know that if I do one step forward, I will be shot. It just drives me crazy. I think, how can any international law, or how can Mr. Erdogan believe he has the right to stop me from going home? So that drives me to start bringing the looted antiquities home. That has been a healing process for me. Now, what do you do when you discover that it is a network of criminals that traffic your antiquities, and that it is an international network of illicit art dealers who push it to greedy possessors or less ethical auction houses or traders? And I'm not putting everybody in the same place, but there are a lot of them, and Cyprus has been a victim to illicit trade. Once I realized that, I understood that this shady world I will never be able to understand unless I befriend one and spare the others. And it wasn't like I came out with a strategic plan. I was a kid. I was in my early 20s when I was approached by the dealers to compromise me and sell looted art to my country via me. And I think that the Dutch art dealer, the controversial art dealer, Michel van Rijn, he was as intrigued by me as I of him. And I think we began this dance of, I wanted to make a decent man out of him and stop him from selling my looted antiquity, trying to explain to him what it meant to me. And he was trying to make a dealer out of me or to compromise me and sell via me to my country looted art. And the rest is history. At some stage, we both understood that we needed each other, and I convinced him to basically work with Interpol and myself to frame his former partner, which is Aydin Dikman, a Turkish origin dealer living in Germany.
Hmm. You know, as you tell this, and of course, we're talking about, I guess we would call it a sting operation over the course of more than a decade. At so many points, either you or Mr. Van Rijn will be saying something to the effect that we must be careful, we must not do anything to evoke his suspicion. You know, in many cases, Aydin Dikman, the Turkish art dealer who in whose possession so many of these priceless artifacts were, but in dealing with all kinds of people, it was so important not to raise suspicion. And I just got to thinking about what a difficult matter that is. How to act perfectly normal and without any sort of suspicious nature at all. When you are embroiled in this kind of world, that in and of itself had to be so tremendously challenging.
Well, it's even worse than that. And the worst thing is that Michel van Rijn never truly trusted me. He always felt that I'm going to arrest him. And I never trusted him because I always felt he's going to have a trick around the corner for me. So I was working with the Church of Cyprus, the former archbishop who trusted me 100% and gave me the best legal advice I could get. And also, I was an honorary consul, so I was getting a lot of support from the government for advocacy or to bring in the police when needed. So I was the spokeswoman of the white world, let's say. And as Michelle used to say, I'm the spokesman of my world, and don't you cross that line. So I never crossed that line. I would not talk to Michelle's men because it's a macho world there, and he wanted to control his men for his own reasons. And basically, when Michelle tried to trick me or not to work with the police, then I had to be hard on him. And but every now and then, he tried to change his game because he will always be who he is.
Hmm. And we should also mention that through much of this operation, you are married. And for some of this operation, you are a mother. And you're also somebody who has your own company. And you are the honorary consulate to Cyprus via The Hague. So you have much in your life apart from this. And that's part of your book as well, is your desperate efforts to try to keep all of this afloat, all of the various important obligations in your life, including this engrossing mission. We just can't imagine how you managed to do all of this.
Well, I am a mother of three children, and my second child is a mentally challenged young lady. My husband is wonderful, and my kids, they really understand and support my mission. But of course, I've been juggling all of these balls up in the air, but they knew unless I bring these artifacts home, I will never be free. So they've been waiting for me to come to the point where I'll address my inner conflicts and feel free. But I realized at the end of the book that even now I'm not free, because the reason I'm doing all of this is I am a refugee. I remain a refugee, and my inability to have a right to go home will drive me until I have the right to go home. I find it very difficult that the Christians in Cyprus, if we want to go and pray in our churches in the occupied area, that we need to get permission from Turkey. I find that absolutely devastating.
Hmm.
But I have a wonderful family. I'm very blessed.
I'm sure that makes a difference. Well, in the meantime, your story is so remarkable. It is the stuff of Hollywood scripts, but it is not fiction. It is absolutely true and told beautifully in your story, again called The Icon Hunter, A Refugee's Quest to Reclaim Her Nation's Stolen Heritage. It's published by Pegasus Books, and the book includes some beautiful photographs in which we can see with our own eyes some of the priceless artwork which we are talking about and some of the principal figures in this amazing story.
Tasula Hajitofi. I would like, if I may,
yes,
add that there is an America, a strong American link to my story. The first court case was four mosaics of Kanakaria, which were in Indianapolis, and the Church of Cyprus won them. I had a wonderful lawyer that I've worked with, Thomas Klein, and of course this book would not have been a reality if I didn't meet an American lady, Kathy Barrett, in Iceland in 2012, who said to me, you know what, this is a story that every American should hear. And she has been the co-writer with me. So I thank you for giving me the opportunity to come to your country and tell my story. Thank you very much.
It was great to speak with you, Tasula Hajitofi. We wish you very, very well with all that stretches ahead for you. And thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you very much, Greg. Have a great day.
And the time is 8:36. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, I want to play for you an excerpt from an interview about a book called The Orpheus Clock, The Search for My Family's Art Treasures. It is, in some respects, a related story to what you just heard from Tasula Hajitofi. Simon Goodman wrote this book to tell the story of his tireless efforts to return to his family priceless works of art that were ruthlessly plundered by the Nazis during the Second World War. And, of course, that plundering happened on a truly staggering scale. Simon Goodman's book touches on that, but focuses most specifically on Simon Goodman's efforts to retrieve certain priceless works of art that had been part of his family's extraordinary personal collection, a collection of art begun by his own great-grandfather. The book is also the story of the tragic extermination of his grandparents in the Holocaust. The book is published by Scribner. Here is a portion of that conversation in which he describes in a little more detail one of the most priceless works of art in that collection, the work of art which gives the book its title, the so-called Orpheus Clock.
Well, there are apparently about 10 or 11 so-called Orpheus clocks still in existence to this day, but they're all actually made by different goldsmiths. But all the goldsmiths were centered in Bavaria, either in Nuremberg or Augsburg, which Nuremberg was the capital of the German, or the Holy Roman Empire at the time, which is why all the great jewelers, goldsmiths, silversmiths, worked in that area. Our particular one, I'm proud to say, was considered possibly the greatest. The dial was fashioned by Wenzel Jamnitzer, who was probably the preeminent goldsmith of his time, and it's a very incredibly elaborate, beautiful, enigmatic. I mean, it took me a while to see even where the hand was. There's only one hand, by the way. It's an absolutely fascinating, beautiful piece, and yet it combines great mechanical skill that is obviously hidden from the viewer that's inside the case. So it's a remarkable combination of great artistic achievement and advanced scientific achievement for the day. There were many such pieces in his collection. He had quite a series of automatons. Surviving aunt, who's now 97 and lives in Italy's favorite, it was brought out to her on special occasions, was an ostrich that would flap its wings every hour, and there was a little gold monkey in front of it that would beat its drum. There was another silver Dutch lady that would strum a lute. These were extraordinary mechanical toys, I suppose, but fashioned out of beautiful materials and exquisitely put together. So I'm not surprised he was fascinated by all this. I've become, if following in his footsteps, equally fascinated.
As you describe this specific clock, the Orpheus clock, you say, as if you visualize all of its exquisite features, you say one has an idea of the mechanical mastery and artistic genius of this clock. We're speaking with Simon Goodman about his book called The Orpheus Clock. I think it's so telling that towards the end of the chapter that you focus specifically on your great-grandfather Eugen Gutmann, that when you describe his children and something about their lives, and in particular his youngest child, his son Fritz, your grandfather, you end the chapter in this way by saying, unlike Eugen, who had lived in an era and in a country that, though flawed, had allowed him to flourish and prosper, Fritz was entering an era of upheaval and great uncertainty. I'm so glad that you make that observation, because I think for many of us who maybe look at history through too casual and careless an eye, that is the kind that's the kind of thing that we tend to not think about. The fact that, in a sense, timing is everything, and that the circumstances in which one is living can make all the difference between a life of happiness and prosperity and a life that descends into unspeakable horrors. And that is the distinction between these two men.
Well, that's right. My poor grandfather had the misfortune of being in two world wars. So his father's life, in comparison, was one of peace and luxury. I mean, the Germans had a war with France, the Franco-Prussian War, but the Germans won, and there wasn't any conflict actually on German soil. So Germany was largely a peaceful country during my great-grandfather's life, and also it coincided with an enormous advancement in the social economic conditions of German Jews. So my grandfather, in a way, epitomizes that rise, and his father before him too, whereas my grandfather suddenly is thrust into the turmoil of the early 20th century. Even the First World War, I devote a fair amount of description to that. He spends the First World War in a British camp, poor man.
Right, on the Isle of Man. It's his. You say Fritz's incarceration began in a rather civilized manner. Explain why he was incarcerated.
Well, because he was a German citizen. It was as simple as that. World War One broke out unexpectedly. I mean, people were expected that there would be maybe a war at some point, but nobody knew when. And then when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo, suddenly all hell let loose. My grandfather was the director of the London branch of the Dresdner Bank at the time. And so they lived in Surrey, just south of London. My father was actually born there, which is fortunate, so he qualified for a British passport. When First World War was declared, all able-bodied men of German and Austrian citizenship were rounded up. The women and children were let go, so my grandmother with her baby, my father, were allowed to get on a freight ship some and sail to a neutral country, Holland or Sweden, you know. And my grandfather was taken up to the Isle of Man, you know, sort of lonely, windswept island in the Irish Sea. And he stayed there for about 3 years until a Swedish diplomat, a family relative actually, was able to have him exchanged. They did a sort of prisoner of war exchange, and he ended up in Holland himself, which is where he decided he actually liked the peace of Holland, which had been neutral in the First World War, and he decided to settle there. Also prophetically, because I think he wanted to distance himself from Germany.
Right. So he was interned in a place roughly comparable to the infamous Japanese internment camps here in America during the Second World War. This was a sort of comparable experience. I do want you to take a moment to explain one of the most extraordinary, though small, moments in this epic story, namely the astonishing surprise which you found in a small shop, which brought you a tangible connection to this chapter of your grandfather's life.
Oh yes, I was in Holland, I've been often, you know, and I go through all the museums, and I was actually in a sort of antique bookshop, quite by chance. I don't know if it's by chance or if there's something leading me to these things, because I've found many artifacts that had once belonged to my family. So I wonder how. I have a sixth sense perhaps for this. I found the first print of a ex libris seal that another inmate, who was obviously an artist, an artisan, who had been incarcerated with my grandfather on the Isle of Man during the First World War. He'd made this ex libris stamp for so that my grandfather could, you know, imprint all the books in his library with it. And this was the first sort of etching of what the stamp, the seal, would look like. And he'd signed it and dated it Douglas, which is the sort of capital of the Isle of Man, 1917. And so this little engraving was in a smallish frame, about sort of 8 by 8. And I saw it hanging on the wall behind this musty bookshelf. And I realized that it, you know, if I squinted, it had... it says Ex Libris F.B. Gutmann, which are those are the initials and family name of my grandfather. So, of course, I bought it right away. I tried to conceal my excitement because I didn't want to, you know, put myself in a position where they charged me twice as what they would get from anybody else. But so I kept my cool and bought it for quite a reasonable price and took off. And I mean, this was in, I was outside The Hague, so this actually wasn't far from my grandfather's last residence before he was arrested by the Nazis. Amazing. So, you know, I can only imagine it was probably one of those little things that was left behind by the Nazi looters, who they left the crumbs to the sort of the Dutch collaborators who stripped the house of the final bits and pieces that was even down to the pots and pans in the kitchen. So this is probably somebody had taken it out of the house in 1943, and it had ended up, you know, here we are in 2000s in this antique bookshop. Just, I mean, The Hague is only about 25 miles from my grandparents' old home.
One of the things I appreciate about the portion of the book in which you describe your grandfather Fritz and his wife, their life in Holland between the wars, is that you help us understand how he and other members of your family and other members of this sort of sector of German society and those who were living in other places like Holland, how they could possibly miss the mounting horror with the rise of Nazism until in so many cases, tragically, it was too late for them to save themselves from it. And I think, for many of us who look back on this portion of history, it's such a hard thing for us to understand. Yeah. And so especially, of course, a tragic story for your grandfather who made the choice not to leave Holland and flee for England like others were.
Yeah.
Say a word about this portion of the story in which you try to kind of understand maybe the seeming unwillingness or inability of some people to understand what was happening.
Well, I suppose because nothing quite as awful as the Holocaust had ever taken place in history before. Germany had been quite a civilized country, and I think people of my grandparents' generation understood that Hitler was a crackpot, but they probably thought he could be controlled, or that he'd have his fling, you know, he'd have his day in power briefly, and it would be a catastrophe, and the Germans would kick him out. And then my grandparents particularly had already moved countries. They'd settled in Holland. They were very happy and comfortable in Holland. I think my grandfather just, you know, didn't feel able to leave again. Also, he was presiding over not just his own, most of his art collection, but also the family silver and gold collection that he was the custodian of. I guess he felt he couldn't just run and abandon it. I mean, everybody was surprised by how quickly the Germans invaded when they did, and how quickly Holland, Denmark, you know, France, Belgium, they all fell within a matter of days. It took the British by surprise. It took everybody by surprise. My grandfather did actually, though, prophetically send my father in England a cable saying, don't come back. So he sort of knew enough of what was perhaps going to happen to tell his children, stay away. And also he figured his daughter, my aunt, was safe in Italy for the time being.
Mm.
And yet he couldn't leave himself.
Right. I think one of the most touching moments is in the book is this, at the end of this chapter called The Ephemeral Peace. You write, Bernard, that would be your father, one of their sons, sent telegrams imploring Fritz and Louise to leave Holland and join him in Britain while there was still time. Stubbornly, Fritz refused, though he certainly had the means to do so. It's one of those situations in which I want to shout back across the generations to ask my grandfather why he stayed. Why didn't he and my grandmother drop everything and flee? But there are no answers. In the section of the book called Devastation, you, of course, recount this nightmare as it envelops your grandparents. And in particular, the role that this priceless art collection played and the fact that it was plundered bit by bit, in which your grandfather was compelled to sign away portions of it to the Nazis. It's hard to even fathom what that would feel like for someone of your grandfather's station in life to be placed in such a humiliating situation, grasping after a hope that his cooperation would somehow lead to the survival of himself and his wife, hopes, of course, that ultimately were dashed.
Well, that's right. He still, I suppose, at least at the beginning of the invasion of Holland, he thought he could negotiate with these people. One of his neighbors, called Catalina von Panwitz, through actually my grandfather's sort of brokerage, if you like, was able to turn over most of her collection to Göring's agents, and she was allowed to leave the country. So in the early days, it was a sort of a period of flux, but gradually the noose tightened, and they just peeled away at the collection bit by bit. You know, the money, what money theoretically ever was paid, very below market value. I mean, although whatever market value would have been in the middle of a war, you know, whatever pittance was paid went into a frozen bank account, and usually those banks at the end of the year transferred all what they called euphemistically abandoned Jewish assets. They were sent back to Berlin, where they transferred into Nazi war bonds, which was usually the sort of shell game they played with their money. Bit by bit, everything was taken. I discovered a series of letters in the German National Archives in Koblenz on the Rhine River between two of Hitler's top Nazi agents, a man called Haberstock and another one called Berler, where they, between themselves, magnanimously agree that they will leave my grandparents a certain amount of their furniture in the house, at least as long as they, quote-unquote, stay in the house. Which the implication was they realized that it wouldn't be long before they would no longer be there. But they thought they were being such gentlemen, saying, well, we'll leave them some chairs to sit on. but eventually even those were taken away.
And, of course, ultimately, your grandparents are taken into custody, ultimately taken to Theresienstadt,
yes.
And ultimately their lives are extinguished, yes. Along with the lives of so many others lost in the Holocaust. In the last couple of minutes, I want us to return to what is the heart and soul of your book from that point on. That is your tireless efforts to secure at least some of the incredible art treasures that had been part of your family once upon a time. As you have engaged in this struggle, which you recount in fascinating detail, I wonder if you can say a word about what this quest has meant to you emotionally, and what have these successes, some small, some significant, what have they meant to you on a very personal, sort of emotional level? What has this quest brought to you?
Well, mostly it's been a very gratifying experience because it proves that one man, I used to be in the music business. I had no idea of anything like this could ever be done, achieved. I'm surprised by what I have managed to do along with my brother and others, and I'm very proud of the fact that, because everybody warned me at the beginning, you can't change the past. Well, I beg to differ. I have somehow been able to reach back and tweak the past in some way. And if it's possible to right even the tiniest little wrong that took place back then, I feel very, very good about it. Also, I'm proud of the fact I was able to tell this story, and now the book is out there. I hope a lot of people read it. I think it's an important story, and there are aspects of it, certainly, that have never been told in such detail or from such a personal point of view, a family's point of view before.
Exactly.
So all of this is a big step in the right direction. I think along the way, I've seen a lot of changes, for instance, in the art world. When I started on this quest, the big auction houses were vehemently opposed to what my brother and I were doing. Today, however, they both have, the two big auction houses, have restitution departments, well-stocked and staffed and headed by quite powerful vice presidents who actually I can count as my friends today. If something comes up at Sotheby's, for instance, with my family's name in the provenance, they actually call me. So this is a huge step in the right direction, that it is possible for one little guy to make a difference, is the bottom line.
Simon Goodman and his amazing book is called The Orpheus Clock, The Search for My Family's Art Treasures. Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to have an exciting and interesting program. It begin with a preview of this weekend's concert by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra, a concert that will focus on the music of Beethoven, and a concert which will actually be presented in kind of a dual format of concert and lecture to help people understand the greatness of Beethoven. It should be really, really interesting. Also, I'll speak tomorrow with a master musician with the